This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. You can subscribe to the app on Apple and Android. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
The Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
Yes, indeed. We're back after a week off. It's me, Lucy Porter, with my Celebration of Women, with a fantastic studio guest today. We've got the lovely Rosie Willoughby, to whom I will be talking about things like monogamy, polyamory, 90s feminism. There's a lot of fun to be had there. And we will be discussing issues of the day, but we will also be featuring our album of the week. Now, it had to happen sometime, and today is the day that finally it's Kate Bush, the love of my life. So let's hear some Kate Bush. Let's let it just go all the way to the end. There it is. Yes, Kate Bush running. That was a different version of Running Up That Hill that I wasn't expecting, where she suddenly gets a bit sort of breathy and masculine. I liked it. It did things to me. So that is our album of the week. Kate Bush, The Whole Story, which we will discuss more later on. But frankly now, from one of my favourite women, Kate Bush, to another of my favourite women.
Oh, wow.
Rosie Willoughby.
I feel humbled with that.
A similarly... I'm trying to think of the similarities between you and Kate Bush, really.
Well, I don't know. I did used to be a singer many years ago. I had my own band.
Yes.
And I used to sing and write my own songs. So, yeah. And
obviously, the similarity is you're both talented musicians.
Yeah, I mean, wow, gosh, bow down to Kate Bush and her incredible talent. But actually, one of her albums, it has a real kind of really strong memory for me that I remember going to. You know, when you used to go to the Virgin Megastore and you could listen to a album on the listening post.
Yes, indeed.
I remember listening to her album Red Shoes when I first arrived in London, and just instead of, you know, just listening to a bit, I ended up listening to the whole thing. I was just really transfixed. I'd heard tracks like Running Up That Hill before when I was at school and stuff, but that album just really, I just loved it. I just thought, wow, this is just really compelling. I just remember sort of standing there transfixed, sort of frozen to the floor.
As the Megastore staff looked at you and
thinking,
what goes, cheapo.
Yeah, but I did buy it on cassette.
Oh, those were, because of course, now which one of her, in fact, was it The Hounds of Love? There was one of her albums that was designed for cassette or vinyl, because it was one side of sort of pop and then the other side was a sort of concept album.
Yeah, well, that's what you used to do.
I know, I miss that. I really do. I miss so much about vinyl and cassette. Well, the thing I don't miss about cassettes is
they'd get chewed up
and
you'd have to wind it back in with a pencil.
Yeah, I know.
Absolutely. Fix it with a bit of salicylic.
I'm just finishing.
The young listeners will be like, what are you talking about?
No idea, I know.
Cassette?
We'll talk about what were those things that were the bridging digital, you know, the little
mini discs.
Oh, I'll tell you what,
they were around for all of 5 minutes.
I know, and I invested heavily in the mini disc. That was a
did you get a Betamax as well?
Yes.
All the defunct,
and I still believe that they were the best. Good. So lovely, Rosie Willoughby. It's really nice to see you.
Very good to see you.
I've got a sort of a slew of topics lined up.
A slew, a
to
veritable
talk to you
slew.
About. Well, in fact, because I'm going to launch our list of the week. We do a list of the week every week. And in fact, it wasn't actually last week, it was the week before last, because we had a week off, which I must say, producer Amanda, happy birthday.
Oh,
her birthday fell in the week
just
passed. It was, I wasn't there.
But you did send me a text.
I did send you a text.
I thought that's very nice of you to remember, considering you're on your holes. So.
Yeah, more than enough, really. The present's on its way. It's so expensive and difficult to deliver.
Is it a lifetime supply of pims?
Well, they've still not been in touch, have they?
Still plugging away at that one. We're trying to get pims to... heavily sponsored the show in a liquid format.
Because it'll be Pim's hour in the second hour, except probably not for Amanda, because she's overindulged with her birthday.
I have, but now I'm looking at the three cans that you've
brought. I think it's going to be first hour, isn't it?
It's going to be minute two. But yes, it was Amanda's birthday. And I was away, that was why we weren't here last week. Because I realised that what I had done was the day after the election, I left the country. Like a sort of left-wing Katie Hopkins. Because and I hadn't realised when I booked the holiday, I hadn't sort of thought about that would be what I was doing, but it was actually quite nice. I did feel like I'm storming off
in response
to what happened. I think I will surprise no one by saying I wasn't thrilled with the election results.
Yes, I don't think any of my network of people on Facebook, any of my comedian friends were into it, really.
No, hilarious though how you realised that your Twitter is not representative of the general nation's opinions.
That is when we realise exactly
that. It was
that.
A good lesson. It was a very good lesson.
Indeed.
But although we do now have the gayest parliament, I'm trying to find things to cling to.
Yes,
to cheer us up. We have the gayest parliament in the world, so there's something, isn't there?
It's probably been gay all along, but they just went out.
Gay, exactly.
that's the difference.
My God, we have the gayest parliament, certainly. But it's good and bad. The list we had the week before we went away, that was it was gender stereotypes that baffle you. So things that your gender is meant to like, that you just don't get. So with Amanda and I, it was shoes. We don't get why women are meant to be obsessed with shoes, because we just don't get it. And we had lots of people sending us their ideas. I'd got a couple of Ed emailed to say that he found growing up in the 80s and 90s as a working class man, the fact that he preferred wine to beer was a massive torment to him, and he has never understood why beer is a male drink and wine is a female drink. There's no sort of physiological basis, is there, for that? Surely is just cultural, because booze is booze, isn't it?
And just the glass it comes in as well. I mean, it's just because glass is so... Yeah.
Sometimes it comes in like that huge tankard with a huge handle, and it's really hard to lift the thing. You know?
You've touched so there, Rosie, like on one of my bugbears, which is the current mania for different types of glasses. So you go to a pub, and instead
they're all branded.
You order around, and you go right. Three. If you're buying, say, 3 pints of lager beer or something, and you think, oh, I'll get three. Yeah. I'm doing the.
Carrying the 3 pints.
And then
now.
You get 1 pint which is in a normal pint glass. You get one that's in a tankard, one that's in a chalice.
Yeah.
One that's like a yard
like
of ale.
A chalice.
I don't mind a chalice, but it's
not
hard
a poisoned one.
To incorporate into your pint hands. That's all I'm saying. I just think. And don't get me started on jam jars, but anyway.
I don't often order jam at the bar. A lovely
just a
pint of strawberry jam top.
Pint of marmalade, please. Yeah. So I was with Ed on that one. I think, yes. Similarly, like when I was a younger woman, I used to drink pints, and it always felt a bit like you were trying to be one of the lads, and you know, it was the 90s. So
yeah,
it was
that was the whole thing, ladette culture, was it not?
And I felt like, yes, I was buying into the whole ladette thing, but then, you know, my tastes have changed as I've got older.
It's
Pimm's all the way for me.
In Australia, when their pint, well, it's not a pint, it's just slightly smaller, it's a schooner, I think.
Oh.
And it's like about three quarters.
Yeah, it's about that, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's just a nice amount, I think.
It's good. Neither too much nor too little. That's very good. So, Ed, we take your point, Ed, and we agree. Then Rachel, she said something that she sort of is a bit baffled by is why, as a woman, she's meant to be very upset about the toilet seat being left up. And she said this is something that's never occurred to her as a massive issue. And I I know what you mean, Rachel. It is, of all the things that I find infuriating...
It's not the most difficult.
Leave the toilet seat up, just do fewer of some of the other bad things. So that's I think we've completed that list. I think that's all good.
Gosh, we've really put the world to rights now. I feel we've sorted things.
Now we know the baffling things about being... In fact, and lots of other women as well saying bags and shoes, that they don't understand bags and shoes. It's almost like it's just an advertising device to make us buy things, isn't it? It's almost like it doesn't really touch something deep in the female psyche at all.
But they're missing something, because I think there's lots of men. I know lots of men, not gay men, straight men, who would like to buy more kind of clothes and girly things and
accessories.
Yeah, I really do. You know, but they feel they're not supposed to. They're just supposed to carry things in a plastic bag or in their hands, their bare hands. Yes.
What kind of man are you if you can't carry everything you need in your bare hands? Yeah. I know. I mean, actually, I don't mind a bag. I'm not saying I object to the concept of bags.
No, they're quite useful.
They are quite useful. But yes, I think, you know, yes, cheap and cheerful, fun bags for men. That's what we can market.
Yes.
So that was the last list. Today's list is in honour of something we're going to talk about imminently, Rosie. The concept of monogamy and whether indeed monogamy is dead, which is something that
I wonder why you brought this topic up today. Yes, I have spoken about this.
Then we will speak about it in a second.
Yes.
And I thought we would do a list about marriage.
Yeah.
Because the nature of marriage and weddings is sort of slightly more up for grabs than it ever has been.
Yeah.
We were all excited by the gay cake this week, of course.
Oh, yes.
The Northern Irish gay cake.
Yes.
So I basically, the list is ways to make marriage less sexist, or ways to de-gender marriage, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
Because, I am married.
Mm-hmm.
Very happily. Very
good.
Happily,
good.
Everyone. Very good. Happy. Good. Good for me.
Good. You said it a few too many times.
Did I raise it? Did I say very happy marriage
very,
that
very,
I have?
Very
marvellous.
Happy, yes.
Wonderful. So, but yes, and the whole the business surrounding engagement and marriage and proposals and honeymoons and all a bit fraught, I would say, and a bit difficult. And you do feel like I didn't make a speech at my own wedding, largely because I feel like I talk enough. but you know, it did feel like women were not represented. Women's voices were not represented in my wedding, which is something that I regret. So that's the kind of thing. It's just things about weddings that you find a bit irksome or irritating. There was an awful, fundamentally awful video that I saw this week, which was to do with catching the bouquet. And there was some guy who his wife, or no, not his wife, obviously his girlfriend, was about to catch the bouquet at a wedding, and he stood up and knocked it out of her hand. And it was just a sort of a lot of people going, hey, good on you, mate. And but yes, it just that whole thing about it's weddings kind of reinforce the idea that women are desperate to get married, men don't really care, blah, 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 blah. So that's my list. So
that's
far have got women should be allowed to make speech. You know, I think that there should be equal representation in speeches, like panel shows.
Well, I mean, if women can't make speeches, you'd probably have a bit of a problem at a lesbian wedding, because obviously we can get married now. And I went to my first lesbian wedding just recently. It was actually my ex, but we're very good friends now. I wasn't there to sort of like throw spiders.
It should have been me. I can't stand it. It should have been me.
But it's funny, actually. I think it's quite a gay thing to stay friends with lots of your exes, because there's not so many people you've kind of got to.
it's a village.
Loads of people said to me, is it not weird? Is it not weird being your ex's wedding? And I was like, oh no, I hadn't really thought about it. But it was strange, because she chose to do a fairly traditional wedding, like with her dad giving her, well, her dad actually gave her and her partner away, because her partner's Australian and her family are all over there, so he walked them both down the aisle.
Aww,
which was actually very
nice.
Was actually really sweet. But then it was very funny, because he didn't know where to go when he got to the end. He obviously hadn't rehearsed this bit and just sort of wandered off, and then his wife called him and went, Bonnor! it was all very sweet. But there is that awful thing, because I did a little comedy film. I'm sort of squeamish about the whole marriage thing. I did a little comedy short film with another comedian, Sarah Campbell, where we did two brides arguing about who got to wear the dress.
Yes,
because I think that would be a big issue. But yeah, who gets to make the speech as well? I don't know.
Well, you see, because the I also have only been to one lesbian wedding and a few male gay weddings, and I'm trying to think the lesbian wedding I went to, everyone looked lovely, but there was no sort of traditional bride setup, which I think
that's quite nice.
And because I wore a dress, which is not something I often do. I should have really worn a trouser suit, but the pressure to conform does strike you in slightly strange ways, doesn't it?
Was it a white dress?
It was of a white hue.
If
I'm honest, it was a bloody
whitish.
My it was designed by a friend of mine who normally makes costumes for burlesque dancers.
Oh.
And she had nipple tassels. Her signature, that really impressed. I look at my wedding photos now and I go, wow, that was, you know, racy.
Brilliant.
It was racy.
Oh, I quite like the idea of a racy wedding
dress.
Yeah,
exactly. I think that sounds like my husband wore morning suit, top hat and tails. So we did, I always say it looked like
a codpiece.
Yes, we had a sort of Game of Thrones themed wedding. It was really, but no, it did. It looks like a Victorian gentleman has come upon a fallen woman in our wedding photo.
Cause rescued her.
Just like, oh, bless you, Governor. I was destined for the workhouse if you ain't coming on. It is ridiculous. But yeah, so, you know, I think there are, I think it's a nod to tradition. Often you think, yeah, it would be nice, but then you realise how deeply...
What that baggage is.
Yes, yes,
I know.
Yes.
Well,
the whole business of proposals as well, I think, is incredibly fraught.
I know, but I think we have... I sort of have very mixed feelings about whether I even wanted to sort of have gay marriage. I thought when we had civil partnership, that was quite good, and I'd quite like to see straight people being able to,
yes,
to have that as well. But I think in some ways it does make us rethink the whole concept of marriage and what that whole ceremony should look like, because now suddenly it can look very, very different, and that is a good thing. But of course, you know, if we do try and stick to tradition, then lesbians would never get married, because the problem is if you're waiting for the man to ask, then
nothing's
going to happen. You know,
well,
everyone's just waiting.
That power dynamic is very interesting, isn't it? Because I think that, I mean, I know a lot of women have waited so long.
Oh, they waited, right.
And then have eventually cracked and gone, like, well, this is, you know, it's make or break. And so it becomes a horrible thing where, and it's, I think it's a terrible pressure on men in heterosexual relationships. I think there is a terrible pressure on men kind of going, well, you've got to, not only have you got to propose, you've got to do it in an amazing way with a flash mob that goes viral and, you know, it's got to be adorable. So I think a lot of men are sort of put off doing it. Good men are put off doing it. Horrible men can use it as a sort of manipulative tool of a kind of, which I have seen done. Of that sort of, well, if you want me to ask you to marry me, you're going to have to toe the line. You know, and that's, I mean, you don't want to marry that kind of guy anyway. But I've seen that done.
No, I don't.
No, I don't really. But I wouldn't recommend it at all. But yeah, and I do think, yes, it is a real, it's a burden on men, and it is a terrible thing for otherwise very strong and capable women that I know who have sort of ended up going, oh, I've sort of got to wait, because if I do ask him, then it's always going to be a bit of a thing when people say, how did he propose? And you have to go, well, actually.
Oh, yes.
But, yeah.
Does that take away his manhood, his authority?
Yes, and takes away your girling, blushing, girlish femininity. But, so there are many things. But anyway, the whole concept of marriage and monogamy is something that you have explored in a fascinating way.
Well, I did a show, my Edinburgh show, in 2013, so nearly 2 years ago. It was called Is Monogamy Dead? And I did a whole survey looking at what actually counted as cheating, or what people thought counted as infidelity. And it was quite surprising in a way, because obviously you think, oh, sex, you know, or kissing maybe. But there were so many things that, like, really emotional forms of perhaps in a form of infidelity that people rated really highly as well, like falling in love with somebody else but with no sexual contact, or, you know, text or email flirting, or staying up all night talking to somebody, you know, all of these different things which people felt actually that might not be so comfortable if my partner was doing that. But then on the flip side of that, you know, I had conversations with lots of people who were in open relationships, completely honestly negotiated, or who were polyamorous in that they have multiple relationships and it's all totally declared and everyone's fine with it. And then I had a conversation with my ex, who recently got married, and she, I said to her, would you ever have an open relationship? She said, no, never do that. But, but what about love affair friendships?
Ooh.
I was like, oh. And so she kind of uses that as a term for herself to describe her very romantic friendships, normally with straight female friends. So she knows there's a barrier there that it's not going to be a sexual relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
But these are very, very enduring, really deep friendships with quite a romantic kind of context.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just thought that's really interesting, and that kind of language.
Well, people always talk about girl crushes. You know, there is that thing about, oh, I've got a total girl crush on Kate Bush.
And, and I think, you know, men maybe don't feel able to talk about it so much, but you have romances, you know, and those really strong connections between guys sometimes.
Maybe. I don't know why it really makes me, it just does really make me laugh when my husband and his friends are sort of so obviously very loving and caring about each other. Yeah. But if you did sort of suggest, like, oh, you really love Jim, don't you? You know,
he'd be like, oh no,
I love him.
He's a dickhead. I can't stand him. But yeah, it is. But it is very sweet. I mean, I sort of struggle, I suppose. But like, I'll tell you what I thought was interesting was that, what was the percentage of people who said that even thinking about someone else?
And that was about seven. There's seven people.
That's
7%.
Still quite a lot, isn't it? Of people think that.
Because I think, come on, how can we even? You can't police that, can you?
Well, I know thought policing.
No, I mean,
well, do you know what I was thinking the other day? Is that you're like, because now, any time people get accused of a crime or anything, they always go through their internet search history, and I just think, God, that is a very dangerous. Because like sometimes, innocently, I will be looking up someone on the internet. You know, you just go, oh, that's
completely
interesting. You know,
innocently.
that actor. That I'm very interested in his work. I'd like to see more about his thought and his working processes. And if he happens to have his top off, then okay.
Then fine. Yeah,
I can deal with that. You know, but yeah, and I think, God, if you were one of that 7%,
oh wow,
and you ever got hold of it, because I mean, I don't. Would never dream of looking
paranoid
at my partner's, my husband's internet search history. I think, I mean, you know. I did once with an ex-boyfriend.
You never find anything good, do you?
Oh, my God. Well, he was there. And,
okay.
And I said, oh, well, let's have a look at what kind of pornography you look at. And then, oh, dear. Yeah. Not good. Really not a good idea. Because it wasn't. I don't know what I was expecting. Like he'd be looking at pornography, which was just, you know, men and women holding hands by sunset or something. But it was of a more niche taste, shall we say, than I had anticipated.
Right.
Anyway, good. Niche. Right, too much information. Hello. Let's reel back from that one. If anyone wants to get in touch with any suggestions for, you know, if you've looked at your partner's internet search history and you want to share it with us, please do, with the names of specific sites.
Yes, their niche sites.
Then that would be great. But do you think monogamy is dead? What was your conclusion? Because presumably at the end of the Edinburgh Festival, you have to have a conclusion.
Well, I mean, this is a show that's kind of run, because I've been asked to do it at loads of science festivals and do debates and panel discussions, and I've written loads more articles, and I'm currently talking to an agent about writing a book that they're interested in. So it's kind of run in that I think that it's monogamy's in trouble, in a sense, in the way that the original meaning of it from the Greek was monos gamos, meaning one marriage is what it means, and for life. You know, divorce rates are kind of pretty high.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't think it necessarily means that anymore. And, you know, I watched a lot of my friends breaking up, and, you know, I've looked at different patterns and habitual patterns of men and women.
Female civil partnerships have a really higher dissolution rate.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, because what you sort of imagine is that women might you know, when the way you're talking about women sort of waiting to get married and everything, and you might think women would be more, you know, into the whole marriage thing, but actually in the gay world, the statistics are that women are actually breaking up at twice the rate of male couples. Wow. Who are really staying together and sort of staying emotionally faithful for longer, whereas some of them might have a sexually open arrangement.
That's your theory, is that actually they're getting their sexual desires, needs fulfilled?
Well, yeah, I do, and that's kind of, I think that's quite interesting, and I think, you know, that if that is working for them as a model, I think that's something to think about. You know, I think the
George Michael model, as I refer to it.
Good old George.
Yes.
But, you know, I think if you can communicate about that stuff, then you're communicating at a really high level, because you've got to actually talk about sex that openly, that you can even think about what your boundaries are about potentially having some kind of intimacy with other people. I mean, it's made me and my partner communicate at a way, way higher level, even though we've only sort of gone into it in quite a sort of timid kind of a way. I mean, we're not really
I love the fact you, I can just imagine that you can easily have the sort of theoretical conversation other people. What about when other people do it? What do you think about that?
I really, really find it fascinating. I suppose I came from the perspective of being a frustrated serial monogamist, and sometimes that was me sort of getting a bit unhappy in a relationship, or sometimes the other person. And I think I come from a culture in the lesbian community where there is a lot of serial monogamy, and I kind of find that frustrating. It just feels a bit tedious, even though, yes, we all stay friends and we seem to negotiate that quite well. It's like, well, I'd quite like to stay with someone a long time, so how is that going
to
happen?
You'd like to not have to go to your ex's weddings all the time. Really.
Exactly.
You've got to buy a lot of outfits, you've got to buy a lot of presents.
I know.
It's a hassle. But
I only did quite a cheap present.
This is for the years of bitterness. have a John Lewis voucher, but only for £10. Not going to spoil you. No, there's an article that people can access, I guess, on the New Statesman website.
Isn't it
Time We Admitted We're All a Bit Polyamorous? To which the comments, of course, there's lots of really interesting and brilliant comments.
There was quite a balanced debate.
How dare you? I'm not polyamorous. And you go, oh, yeah, you're a little bit defensive. But again, like me and my, my marriage is very happy. Thank you. Why are you so upset about even thinking about
it? What's really interesting, though, is there were people who just read the heading and then didn't read the article. And there's a lot of that. People that do that, especially as what's funny is I didn't even write that heading. Of course, the New Statesman wrote that.
Would be fun to be a sub editor and just give every article some completely different, you know,
nothing to do with what it means.
Yes, exactly. Who likes gingerbread men? is the day of the bun over? And see what they say. But it is. I think people are fascinated by it because. Because we've all had relationships that have failed, and you think, well, are we all destined just to be miserable serial monogamists? And like you say, that in the article, the impact that has on children and families, and you have to start again with a whole new social group, and you lose all of the good stuff about that.
You do. You lose loads of good stuff. I mean, I know a lot of people thought it was a little bit kind of. Pretentious, but I actually thought the old conscious uncoupling was quite a good way of putting it when old Gwyneth and Chris.
I've got a lot of time for Gwyneth, I really do, and I know that's not maybe a popular opinion, but I'm very fond of them.
Yeah, but they were recognising the really good things about their continuing relationship, but that a chapter of that relationship had ended. And that the relationship had changed.
And
I think they were doing that in quite a grown-up, mature way. Whereas a lot of us, we think, I'm not happy today, so I'm going to break up with you.
The problem is, this is sort of, I think, as much as I say I do love Gwyneth, I can also see why people find it slightly irritating. And why there is something still about the idea of open relationships that is very swingersy, it's very 70s.
Oh, well, I know.
Well,
I was asked to be on ITV. They had a... I should have known what it was going to be like because it was going to be occupying the Loose Women slot while Loose Women were on holiday. But this very sort of quite serious, earnest researcher rang me and was asking me all these really interesting questions and meaty questions. We had quite a good discussion on the phone. I thought, well, I'm sure this will be bound to be an intellectual debate.
How could this
debate.
Possibly go wrong?
This show presented by James O'Brien and... I was sort of one of the experts in inverted commas, and they'd invited loads of kind of swingers and people like that, and the whole debate seemed to be focused around sex, which yes there is that side to it. There, I did some comedy at a cabaret at a sex party, which was so fun. It's probably one of the best gigs I've ever done because everyone was just in such a good mood because they're gonna have sex. It was brilliant. It's like I don't even have to say anything, any joke, and they're just
woo-hoo!
I know,
brilliant. Just get it over with.
I know,
really.
I only did a short set. But there is all that. But I think the whole emotional angle is so important. And so, there's such a deep, there's a depth to this whole topic that isn't just shallow and just about sex and having orgies and that and that kind of thing. So
I think you're like reclassifying what you need out of all the relationships in your life.
Yeah, and we all have lots of different relationships if we're using it in a broader sense. And what was nice actually was when I met people who were polyamorous and having multiple relationships, when they felt that they'd reached their sort of saturation point and had too many relationships going on, they'd say that they're polysaturated.
Yay! That's very, it's, yes, that's the nice. Old polyamorous means you have sex with parrots. All of that.
Polly, yes.
Good. Well, good. There we go. Well, let's put that to bed. Literally. We've done monogamy there.
Indeed, yeah.
So, done it.
If anyone wants to let us know about ways that marriage could be made more interesting. And I think having all your exes, that all your exes have to come to your wedding. As ushers.
Oh, wow.
As ushers, as witnesses. So they have to, in the bit where they say, does anyone have any objections to this
wedding?
They have
to come in fancy dress. Just them.
Well, in fact, my ex did marry a clown. So, which I didn't actually go to. We're still very close, actually. We're still good friends. But it was, anyway. Good. So, let's have a lovely record.
We're going to have Rosie's record.
Oh,
Rosie, would you like to introduce it?
Well,
you remember what it is?
Yes, this is another. I've got it written down. It's another of my favourite female artists, Goldfrapp, and this track is Rocket.
Lovely.
Lucy Porter on FUBAR Radio.
No, it was like I was blasting off into space there. Ooh. The countdown and then Lucy Porter, off she goes.
Oh, it was, yes.
It's beautiful, the wonderful Alison Goldfrapp. Yeah. Very. Now, tell me, anyone who knows, Rosie or Amanda.
Yeah.
What year was that released?
Ooh.
2000 and...
It was only a few years ago, that
10,
album.
I want to say.
Yeah.
I want this to not make me feel old, because to me, that's quite recent. So I'll tell you what, we'll look it up in the next...
It's about 2010.
I think you're about right. I might go...
Slightly before?
2011.
That's good, you see. Okay. That makes me feel I like some music that's been released in the last 5 years.
I'm sure that was the album before her last one, wasn't it?
Don't know that one.
Anyway, we'll find out.
But I loved her her first album. I think it was called Utopia, or that was one of the tracks. Anyway, I used to. I'm sorry to keep talking about sex, but I used to put that on if I was, if I'd taken someone home for
a bit of
How's Your Father. But it always used to catch me out because track 7 was sort of broke that sensual and wondrous world that she'd created of all this Utopia, and then it was suddenly this kind of like this kind of Bavarian folk waltz, and obviously I don't know how to make out to in 3-4 times.
You have to slap your thighs. Yeah. That's what you have to do. Get your lederhosen on. And
it would always catch me out. It was a sudden change in mood, before. I like your slappy noise.
I don't think there's enough slapping of thighs.
It's like a little horse's canter through.
It was 2010, so you were absolutely
right.
Not
Amanda.
Old, Lucy.
Well done, and you're right, which is the main thing.
Yeah. It's very good. Yeah.
If anyone wants to get in touch and tell us what their shagging music is,
that is fun. I actually know a couple who said they can't agree and they actually listen to separate iPods.
Romance is not dead. That's quite a good idea, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
I could have a podcast on the go. I could be listening to In Our Time with Melvin Bragg.
All right. Oh, so not your own podcast. That
not this
weird.
One. That would be really, really weird. Although I know a lot of male comics who would do that. Let's
yeah, probably.
Let's be honest. We all know them. But
yep.
I've never really had... The only shagging music story I can tell you is that being something of a music snob in my younger days, when I was dating, I went back to this guy's house. We'd been seeing each other for a while, it was all progressing in the right direction, and we were in the bedroom, and he said, I'll just slip on a little bit of music, and he went off and he put on a Now That's What I Call Music compilation.
No.
And I put my knickers on and left, Rosie, when I was not happening.
But they're quite long compilations, so
yes, exactly. I mean, that's for 4 CDs in the old days. Yeah. But yes, and because of course there you get a massive variety of if you make your own compilation. I mean, actually, Justin and I, my husband, who I'm very happily married to,
Very happily married to,
in a very peaceful, monogamous way. the right. But yes, he made me compilations when we first got together. Aww. as people, and I for him
I've done
also
that.
Yeah, and it's quite nice. And then, you know, you sort of, you can make a sort of sexy compilation,
yeah,
so that, you know, you think, well, we're heading that way, and maybe this will. But I always put on quite depressing music. Whatever compilation I do,
I've done that too, and then you think, well, this is actually too sad.
Yeah,
I'm just sick.
Yeah.
I'm just crying.
Just hold each other. Just hold each other and listen to Radiohead. It's fine. Now, I was going to introduce our first topic of the week.
Yeah, do it.
And our first topic of the week is a fairly frivolous one, but I found it amusing, which is the Cannes Festival, the Cannes Film Festival.
Oh yes,
where they kicked off this year with a film by a female director, very much making their point that, you know, the role of women in film is something that needs to be discussed. And so they had a French film by a female French director, Marvelous. Très bien. And they're having talks from various women about women's role in the film industry, all going marvellously. Until they, in a slightly French way, it was revealed that women were being banned from the red carpet for wearing flat shoes. Which just, there's not much to say about this,
no,
but it just really
ridiculous.
Made me laugh.
I
it was sort of, it made me think that, and I am going to be probably slightly racist in a sort of culturally generalising sort of way, but it's sort of like the French attitude to vegetarianism, where, you know, like you go to France and you say vegetarian, they go, oh yeah, you do chicken, it's van or some fish, would you like fish? And it was sort of that kind of the way they've just gone, right, this is the feminist festival, yeah, we will make it
the
women.
But of course they will wear heels.
They must look beautiful.
But
yeah, it was real shooting themselves in the foot, if you will pardon the pun, because they did look like utter dicks.
Yeah, that's just kind of, yeah, really destroy the whole message that you're trying to set up entirely.
It is, but then, actually, red carpet events are, by their very nature, kind of riddled with sexism, in that it is all about the ladies' frocks. And,
yes.
You know,
those red carpets are probably slippery anyway. You know,
you might need your
hiking boots to walk down there.
I know. Well, see, this sort of follows on from what we were talking about last time about not getting shoes. But you see, I don't have a pair of high heels. I can't go to Cannes.
I've probably got more high heels than you.
I
think I've got one or two.
You'd be all right, you see.
I can walk in them, but I find that if I'm at a do, because when I went to the wedding, I did wear high heels, and it's when you start drinking as well. I think I need to do it. I need a breath test for when I'm wearing high heels, because I have a limit.
Maybe concealed within the heel itself.
Yes.
So you blow into the heel.
That's a great invention,
you see. There you go. I'll market that. Any entrepreneurs, any venture capitalists listening who want to back that?
I don't mind wearing a heel now and then, but very, very occasionally. I don't get invited to a lot of red carpets. To be honest.
To be honest, Can haven't been on the phone to
ask. No.
They know you haven't got any high heels.
That's why,
They listened to the show. They were all listening to the show.
Banned for life. But I quite like, whenever I've been to a black tie event within the gay community, lesbians interpret black ties. They'll just wear what they're wearing, like their jeans and a black tie.
Yes, I mean, which is
brilliant.
Entirely appropriate, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
But I once went to a woman's birthday party, and she, I don't know why she'd booked me to do a set at her birthday party, but she got very upset that I had turned up in flat shoes, because she felt that was a sort of an affront. I wasn't giving her event the serious
gravitas.
I don't get it. But the week in film has been quite interesting as well, because something else that caught my eye was the new Mad Max film, Fury Road, I believe it's called. I haven't seen it, which normally would preclude me from commenting on it, but someone else who also hadn't seen it did comment on it, and this really made me laugh.
It's great when people haven't seen it and they feel
and
that they must form an opinion.
And a very,
very rigid one.
Very furious one. And this was from, there's a website called When We Were Kings, which is a sort of men's rights activism site, which is, contributed to by the kind of men who probably wouldn't get on with me, I'll be honest. We probably wouldn't have a lot to talk about. And one of these men had written a review of the new film, having not seen it. He'd reviewed it from the trailers, And said, because it's...
Well, they're always misleading, aren't they?
Well, I know. I mean, God knows how many
films
you've
gone to see.
Been caught out
many times. Yes. That looks brilliant.
Yes, oh, yeah. The three... Especially with comedies.
That was the good bits.
Comedies, you get, yeah, the three good jokes, they're in the trailer.
Yep.
And with action films, the explosion, the really good explosion was in the trailer. So, but this guy on When We Were Kings was furious because this Mad Max Fury Road, which stars Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron, you know, I sort of vaguely remember the original Mad Max, but this is updated. And the story, I think, largely concerns sort of sex trafficking is a large part of it. And this man is furious. He claims that other men are being duped by explosions, fire tornadoes and desert raiders into seeing what is guaranteed to be nothing more than feminist propaganda, while at the same time being insulted and tricked into viewing a piece of American culture ruined and rewritten right in front of their very eyes. Which I love the fury, and I love the fact that he hasn't seen the film, but he's still furious. Mm. And also love the fact that he's saying this piece of American culture ruined and rewritten right in front of their very eyes about an Australian film starring a British and South African actor in the lead. So, you know, it's ill-informed as well as being furious. But it was like the...
These people hang themselves, don't they?
They do. They always give you enough ammunition. It's like the people who are furious about Ghostbusters being remade with women because that's ruining their childhoods. And you think,
is it really?
I'm sad about that. But yes, so the week in film, good and bad. Good and bad for the
I take it's women instead of the Ghostbusters, not instead of the ghosts.
It's just female ghosts.
Female ghosts.
Moaning on the way we're going to. Moan. And my other little sort of mini cultural thing that I found quite amusing was just from today, the Twitter storm of the day, which involved a tweet that had been promoted by Wilkinson Sword Women. And the Wilkinson Sword Women tweet was, "Myth, shaving with your man's razor will give you a closer shave. Fact. Women's razors are designed specifically for the curves of a woman." And then a little smiley face.
But which woman?
Yes. I mean, it unbelievably misguided tweet. And, you know, luckily lots of people were on hand to say yes. Because all women are built exactly the same.
Indeed.
Men's chins are not curved. Men's facial areas and whatever else men choose to shave with their razors. If a man shaves his testicles, is that any different to a lady shaving anything of hers? But yes, it's just because I'm never too harsh on people who do rubbish tweets, because you go, we've all done a rubbish tweet. But it was just the fact they put a smiley face at the end of it kind of saves it for me. It's like, we know this is bollocks. We know utter bollocks, but we're putting it out there anyway.
Do they cost the same, a women's or a man's razor?
Do you know? I don't know. Well,
that would be interesting,
because I do shave
it?
My legs. Yes. I do. I will admit
that. I do.
And I buy the cheapest Superdrug, you know, own brand, because I cannot see how any razor technology is. I mean, I think it is the greatest.
But in the old days, like, there were really rubbish. Those sort of little Bic ones that had only like one blade or something.
Yeah. Well, I just go for a little rubbish one with two blades now.
Two
That's
blades.
The only difference. Yeah. It's got a slight swivel. Slight swivel to the head, but
slight
you wouldn't.
Swivel.
I mean, you know, I do feel maybe I should invest in a, in a better.
Oh, well, I mean,
Who cares?
I've got the occasionally when they're at half price. And I think,
what, the
know,
women's ones?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to get it. A £3, you know.
A Venus.
£3.50, yes, should be £7. Yeah. And I can't say it's changed my life in any way. So
isn't it
save
just,
your money.
I thought it was just the colour of the packet,
yes,
really.
Yes.
Pink.
It is,
isn't that
course.
Pretty much the main?
Because women go must buy pink things.
Must do.
Good, but yes. Anyway, I'm sure that even, I mean, when I looked at that Wilkinson Sword tweet, they'd had quite a few tart replies, and I'm sure they'll have had even more now. So go and look at that, people, if you want to cheer yourselves up. Before, when we were talking about monogamy and relationships, and we were saying, wouldn't it be great to redefine relationships and to, you know, talk about the ways that you can love people, and it's not all about sex. It's not all about sex. We very much said that. And then I wanted to move on now to your great woman who you've chosen to look back on the life and career of. Bearing in mind, it's not all about sex, is it, Rosie? It's not all about sex. So who have you chosen to look at?
Well, the first person that popped into my head, because I'd been thinking about the history of sex research recently, was Virginia Johnson, who was one half of the American sex research team in the late 50s and through the 60s, Masters and Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I got really into it. There was a TV series that was on about their life called Masters of Sex.
Yes, I never saw it. Tell me everything.
The first series was shown on Channel 4, and then they, strangely, the second series, which was like way, way better, got shunted off to More 4 at a weird time of night or something.
Was it American or British?
It's American.
Okay.
So it was produced by something like Showtime or something like that. But I just found their story really interesting because they end up having a relationship together as part of their kind of sexual research project and end up getting married. But they form a really great partnership for learning about sex, which I just think was really interesting and really important at that time. You know, they kind of made discoveries and said things that seem obvious now, but that, you know, wouldn't be said then, about how the fact that, you know, for a woman to have an orgasm, you know, you didn't need a man around, you know, and people didn't say that, you know, back then. And
What was their background?
Well, he was a gynecologist. He was like a really esteemed kind of gynecologist. Mm. And she had been studying, but never actually, she didn't complete her degree. She got this job kind of initially as his research assistant, but became such an integral part of the research because she gave it a human touch. And so she would kind of be able to talk to men and women and all the subjects about their lives and issues and, you know, difficulties they were having. And she, you know, basically could get people to open up and then in their lab get their clothes off and, you know, get down to it, which the sort of slightly, as certainly as he's portrayed in the TV series, slightly frostier Bill Masters probably wouldn't have kind of got that level of intimacy and participation and openness from people. So they really kind of, you know, paved the way for a lot of kind of later research and stuff. And, you know, I think the fact that she was a woman, you know, really meant that women's sexuality came into what they were looking at, and women's pleasure and women's satisfaction, as well as just looking at men, which often often seems to get prioritised for some reason. And I sort of, you know, I started reading about The Real Woman, you know, a little bit, having really got into this TV series, just because I just thought she was quite an interesting woman for her time, in that she had two kids and, you know, she'd separated from her first husband and was quite sexually liberated and was happy to sort of talk about sex and be quite open, but she was sort of viewed a little bit suspiciously by other women that she worked with. She was probably a little bit ahead of her time.
Was your man Masters married when?
Yes.
So that people were right to view it with suspicion. Well, certainly his wife was probably right to view it with a degree of suspicion.
Yes, exactly. I mean, well, you know, but why is it always the mistress that gets
exactly,
the blame?
The other woman, the terrible other woman.
Other woman. Yeah, so, you know. Yes, it's not not always an ideal situation, but yeah, I don't know. I think
I'm not condemning her, by the way. I do feel like I've come down very harsh.
Come down harsh on the other
woman. Poor Virginia Johnson. I'm sure, you know, her great work is testament to her, you know, to her life in a way that
You know, and I think all of those sex researchers, especially the sort of early people like Kinsey as well, and people before that. You know, I think it's just really important, because I, you know, for me as a gay woman, to sort of had people at least document that there are different sexualities and sort of have had literature and books to read and understand that doesn't mean that I'm totally weird and there's something wrong with me. And, you know, all just to understand my sexuality, I think it's just important. And yeah.
What would you say have been the most reassuring or comforting texts and things with a great sort of... What have you drawn comfort from over the years?
I don't know. Well, sometimes things like song lyrics, but, you know, just knowing that we all feel heartbroken. But even just reading some of these books around monogamy and just different types of relationships, I've found really... reassuring. There was a great book I read a couple of years ago called Rewriting the Rules by a woman called Meg Barker, which just really sort of slightly shakes things up a bit about, you know, it's not being prescriptive and saying you would have to have an open relationship, but it's sort of presenting it, you know, as one of many options, and just really encouraging kind of communication and thought and kind of a consciousness about relationships, I guess.
It is the Virginia Johnson story, you do think that is quite a brave, at that time, to be a woman who talked openly about sex. And as you say, as a sort of, you know, the reaction that you would have had from your peers presumably would have been quite hostile and frosty. And
Yeah.
Oh, well, I have to watch the TV series.
Yeah, I can't wait for series three, but yeah.
Which will probably be, now they've shunted it to me before, it'll be on some sort of...
Goodness knows.
Well, you'll be able to watch it online. I'll get one of the young people to tell me how to download it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have chosen for my great woman... similarly, I thought, well, we'll stick on the polyamory theme. And I thought, well, I'll try and find a sort of early example of a polyamorous woman. And I've also, what I've done here, and I don't like to blow my own trumpet, but I've combined a number of threads from the show so far.
Okay, yeah.
So we have Rosie's discussion of different types of relationship, and it also brings in French film, because the woman I've chosen is Marguerite of France... who was born in 1553, and she was the Queen Consort of France from 1589 to 1599, and she had an incredible life. And the French film La Reine Margot, if you remember that film,
yes,
with Isabella Jeannot,
yes,
was based, in fact, Dumas who wrote a play based on her life, or a book based on her life, and so her story has sort of been quite well documented, because she was the daughter of King Henry II of France and Catherine de Medici, and she was queen twice, because she married King Henry III of Navarre, who became King Henry IV of France, and she was Queen of Navarre, then she was Queen of France, and she was a champion of religious openness. And there was this St. Bartholomew Day's massacre, in which a lot of French Protestants were murdered, Huguenots, and she sheltered a lot of the Protestants, and she protected a lot of people at that time. But she was imprisoned for quite a long time by her brother, who became the king. And so during her imprisonment, she wrote her memoirs, and she recounted all of the relationships that she had had, which were many.
Many.
She had been busy, because she was married, you know, she was married off to someone that she didn't love. So she had many lovers during her marriage. The most well-known were Joseph Boniface de la Mole, Jacques de Harlay, Seigneur de Champvalon, and Louise de Bussy d'Amboise. And I think that's how they would have said it.
Absolutely.
But yes, and so.
Because they weren't very good at French back
then.
They only spoke from
Croydon. Croydon accent, that's very well documented at that period in history.
Yeah.
So she's, you know, an early example of a woman who was very open about her sexual appetites and her amorous needs and desires.
Yes.
It's a very good film, that La Reine Margot. I'd forgotten about it.
Yeah, I've forgotten about it. It's a long time ago. What year was that?
94.
Oh, 94. I was looking at Amanda because I thought, you know,
she is the font of all knowledge, but I just happened to
you
have it in front of me.
Fair enough, cheat.
So, yes, there we go. And actually, Shakespeare's early comedy, Love's Labour's Lost, was based on the story of Marguerite de Valois. Anyway, so there you go. Those are interesting women for us to talk about.
Very interesting women.
Sexually active ladies. Right, shall we have another song?
Yeah, and this song is contentiously linked to the first story that we were talking about in this segment, and that is about the shoes.
Let me guess. No, I don't know. It's songs about shoes. The sneaker pimps, they weren't women. Sneakers? Sneakers.
So I'll give you a clue.
He's just going to shout out any kind of shoe.
Brogues.
Flip flops.
The penny loafers. Yes, go on.
The artiste is Kirsty MacColl.
Oh,
can you guess the song?
In These Shoes.
Here
yes.
we are.
I nearly said that,
I know.
Actually.
Oh. Well, you didn't.
I know.
No, the wonderful Kirsty MacColl.
Who you met, Rosie. Yes, I was just saying, I did meet her once when I was... Back when I was doing my music stuff, I briefly had a manager who knew her vaguely and took me to her show and took me to her after show. And she was so lovely and friendly. And she'd never met me before. She didn't have to be nice to me. Some kind of singer-songwriter she'd never heard of. And just gave me a massive hug and was chatting to me and asking me about what I was doing. And, yeah, she was really, really friendly and lovely.
Aww.
And, yeah, we were just saying that track was not long before she died.
Yeah, 2000. Oh. 15 years ago. I tell you what, let's bloody raise
let's
a,
toast,
let's raise a
toast
can of
Kirsty.
Pims to Kirsty, because good Croydon girl as well, I always feel.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, there you go. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
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 Cheers. Cheers. Amanda's decided to join us on the Pim.
She'd be so rude if I didn't.
Yes. The tins don't make a satisfying clink. No cheers noise, do
they? It sounds
really?
Basically like a tramp's get together. Just the clink of a tin. That's what, when in years to come, when we're all on a park bench, we'll remember this and go, oh, do you remember that sound? Oh, yeah, yeah, we heard that once before, didn't we?
It probably won't be Pims then.
We'll still think that people are listening.
That's, to be honest, the mics mind aren't you. Turned on.
There's me thinking the people are listening
exactly
now.
No, we're just, it's the ramblings of elderly drunks talking to the void. It's fine. We're not bothered. We're delighted with that. Good. Now, so, quick little thing. Shoe songs. Can I put in a request, Amanda?
Please do.
For the most depressing song of all time. Oh. Let's play that.
Crocodile Shoes.
Show. Well, that is. God, you know, I once lived in a flat where the person upstairs played Jimmy Nails' Crocodile Shoes.
Oh, good grief.
Repeatedly. And why, of all the songs that you would play... Anyway.
Because She's Lying is clearly better, isn't it?
Exactly. If you, you know, if you've got someone wrong...
Then you're going to play any Jimmy Nails.
But yes, anyway, the track that I would like you to play is Little Red Shoes by Loretta Lynn. Do you know it?
No, I don't.
Oh, God. Oh, it's very hard work. It's brilliant, but it is very hard work. We'll give people a warning when that's coming up so you can get the tissue. It's a very sad song about her
impoverished childhood.
The
sort of warning
childhood.
They do on TV shows may contain upsetting scenes.
Exactly. This next song may distress.
She's Lying. Was that actually Ain't No Doubt was the title?
That's right, yes. Yes.
A woman like this no good for me. Now, if only we could play songs written by and performed by men on this show. I'll do a cover. You're a musician. Do a cover version of that, and we'll play it next week.
Right. Okay.
There you go. That's your task, Rosie, for the next week.
Yeah.
Now, what shall we talk about next? Do you want to talk about Game of Thrones, Rosie?
Oh,
do you know anything about it?
I'm not an expert.
Well, no, I don't really know anything about it either. The only reason...
But I could make it up, like that guy
exactly,
who had not watched Mad
like
Max. I could go,
have you
I
seen
am
the
furious,
trailer?
I'm furious. Yes.
Well,
yeah.
That's pretty much what I was going to do.
Right, okay.
Because this is... Well, there was an article by the lovely Sarah Dighton in the New Statesman, for which you have written.
We're
very heavy on New Statesman today, aren't we?
Plugging them.
If them and Pims could get together and sponsor us, then that'd be great.
There's an alliance.
That's this show in a nutshell, I think.
It is, isn't it?
It's New Statesman.
Women and Pims. It is, which was just about the level of sexual violence in Game of Thrones. I mean, I'm not going to... It's quite good that we don't know anything about it, because we are in no way going to be able to give any spoilers, because,
frankly, we
just don't know what's going on.
I have not got
clue. But more generally, is that there was a distressing incident of sexual violence against a female character in Game of Thrones, apparently. Which, again, we know that's not a spoiler, because apparently that happens the entire time. And it just made me think, it's sort of interesting, the depiction of violence against women on television is incredibly pervasive at the moment, I think. This sort of murder victims... I'm not saying I want to see more men getting murdered, but maybe... I don't know.
Maybe you do.
I don't dislike crime dramas.
No, I mean, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because I actually thought The Fall was really compelling, but also... It is slightly problematic because, you know, it was pretty grisly, and, you know, the women were all victims.
Yeah. And it's a yes, it's just like a sort of culture. Is it a sort of sublimation of misogyny? Is that
but
how?
But hasn't it? Is it? Is this a new thing? I mean, hasn't that been going on for ages? Haven't all the sort of classic murder crime series had female victims,
actually,
like crime suspects over the years?
You look
and
back,
everything
don't
like
you?
That.
And you think, God, yeah, and like Twin Peaks. Yeah. I love Twin Peaks, but you know, you're looking at it's a lot of dead women in Things That I Like.
Definitely.
I don't know how to solve it, Rosie.
No. You're talking like a sort of detective. Yeah. I don't know how to solve it.
Yeah. I'm on the case. What I think I'm going to do is I'm going to write my own historical... Well, see, because I do... I like a historical drama. I like a murder.
Mm.
But I'm wondering if we do it with puppets. So that's my only thought, is maybe if we do
I
it
don't
with puppets.
Think that's been done before, you know.
Okay, right, let's pitch this. So
right.
To any television executives, it's going to be a puppet-based. Because I think somehow that would be... And it'll be male and female puppets. And also puppets of, like, animals and stuff.
that's where it all starts.
Yes.
Talking like a true serial killer.
Exactly. I'm just going to kill a load of puppet animals.
Kill a load of puppet animals, yes.
I really have no idea how to solve it, but that's my solution. If anyone else wants to get in touch and tell us how we cut down on the amount of violence against women on television while still enjoying the murder detective genre,
yeah,
then please... Please do get in touch. That'd be nice. And the other story that caught my eye, which is again a sort of while we're on sort of slightly serious topics, was the now it's just the awful hypocrisy of this man. It's about America and it's about the abortion debate. Yeah. So you know this is always going to be depressing territory, but this particularly just made my heart sad. So a Tennessee Republican is making headlines for voting in favor of a national abortion ban, even after pressuring the women in his own life to have legal abortions. Republican Scott DeJarlais, who is a Republican congressman from Tennessee, publicly opposes abortion and has repeatedly run for office as a pro-life candidate. Last week, he was one of 242 House members to vote for a proposed 20-week abortion ban. But then transcripts, 3 years ago, transcripts related to the congressman's divorce trial showed that DeJarlais supported his ex-wife's decision to legally end two pregnancies. He also had several extramarital affairs and once pressured a 24-year-old woman to have an abortion after she told him she was pregnant with his child. "You told me you'd have an abortion and now we're getting too far along without one," DeJarlais told the woman in recorded phone conversations. "If we need to go to Atlanta or whatever to get this solved and get it over with so we can get on with our lives, then let's do it." And oh my God.
Wow.
It's an extraordinary level. I mean, we're all hypocrites to a degree, but that is an unbelievable level of hypocrisy. And I mean, it is something that worries me a little bit. As someone who is pro-choice, you know, whatever happens in America, you think, oh my God, please don't let that creep over the Atlantic.
No.
But yeah, and I've been around this debate many times with many people, and there is no... You know, I understand the position of people who are, you know, anti-choice, as I would call them, pro-life, as they would style themselves. You know, and I can see how distressing they find the whole concept. But when you see that people who are attempting to impose their choices on other people aren't even consistent in their own lives, you
well,
do start
it's,
to think,
you think, hey, hang on a minute.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Indeed. At my university, we used to have an abortion fund, actually. It was a hugely controversial thing that caused all kinds of huge debates. But, yeah, women could go and access this fund to be able to go and have a private abortion, because it was not particularly easy back then on the NHS.
Yeah,
particularly,
yeah.
We had a not very helpful kind of medical centre and stuff. So, yeah, but it was quite a controversial thing.
Because did you raise funds for this in the feminist society or in...
Well, I think some of the student union funding was siphoned off for it, which is why I guess a lot of people are like, why are we funding this, you know?
Yes, I can imagine that the Catholic Society wouldn't be thrilled I actually had a really interesting and refreshing conversation with a woman recently who is a Catholic, but it's sort of, you know, because having had the debate or conversation a lot of times, you'd think, well, we're never really going to no one's ever going to change anyone's mind. If you are, you know, pro-choice, then you're pro-choice, and if you're not, then you're generally speaking not going to shift. And I've been at a lot of sort of angry panels and things, but this one woman, it was, you know, we had a sort of quite nice chat where she was saying, although I am pro-life, my entire focus is on making it easier for women to have children and making it easier for women to be supported if they do make that choice.
Yeah, which is than, all important too. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, but. Exactly. And I mean, I think that, you know, you sort of go, yes, there. More of that. More of that, please. More of the positive kind of, you know, helping women, whatever their choice may be.
Indeed, yeah.
Then it's good. So, yes. Okay, because you were, talking of your university, I was going to bring up your other show, 90s Feminist.
Right. 90s Women.
Because I had a...
I thought maybe this was all a segue into the depressing song, actually.
Yes, let's pick a song for the end of this segment, Down to Dover or something. But, but yes, tell us about your 90s feminism, activism and life.
Yeah, well, my show that I did last year in Edinburgh was called 90s Woman, which was a sort of part documentary, kind of multimedia extravaganza with video clips, because I went and tracked down a group of women that I had been involved with this feminist newspaper. We'd been on the collective together that created this newspaper back in the 90s, and I sort of found these old newspapers in my parents' dusty old attic. And
what was it called?
It was called Matrix, which was Greek for womb.
Oh.
And I decided to go and find some of the women who'd been involved and find out what they were doing now and if they still called themselves feminists, because I thought there was kind of, even though it's kind of a personal journey and it's a bit of a fun adventure and me recounting some of the silly and idiotic things I did back then to try and impress the woman I had a crush on and sort of coming to terms with my own identity and coming out and all of that kind of stuff, it sort of subtly makes that point that the feminism was just about still hanging on in there in the early 90s, sort of tailing on from the 80s and the 70s, but then it just really disappeared in the 90s, and it's only really come back again now. And I was sort of going, oh, where did it go? What happened? And what was interesting was I couldn't find out how long. It was very difficult to find any archives of Matrix and see how long it had actually continued. You know, so I spoofed up kind of mock ones with the Spice Girls on the cover and it, you know, becoming really, really diluted and, really sort of girl powery. But what was really encouraging was during this whole research and trying to find out what happened, I found this group of women who in 2006 had found one of our really dusty old copies in the back of a student union drawer, and they were inspired to set up Matrix Reloaded.
Ah, that's so nice.
So that was really nice. So I met and interviewed one of them and filmed an interview with her.
Which university was it?
This was at York University, where I was a contemporary of Zoe Lyons.
Ah, yes, and the lovely Zoe Lyons.
Lovely Zoe. And I interviewed her as well, because she fleetingly got involved with the collective as well. Very, very fleetingly, because she had a crush on the same woman that I had a crush on as well. And so Zoe...
And did you tell her to back off and that was her?
Well, no. Everyone kind of had a crush on this sort of enigmatic figure, Kate.
Oh.
And so she was kind of the leader, even though it was a collective and everyone was equal, of course, but there was totally a power dynamic going on, as there always is. And Zoe got involved with, we did this stunt to paint some feminist graffiti and take a photo of it for the cover. So we'd got our green and purple paint and we sneaked around in the middle of the night to paint this graffiti saying sisterhood is powerful. And Zoe was keeping guard. She was like, I'm not painting, going to keep guard on my bike. She was going up and down on her bike. But of course, all these years later, she now admits that she was absolutely terrified, and had anyone come along she'd probably just scarpered off on a bike off on a little red racer. And
didn't she join the police in the end? Wasn't she in the police for a while?
No, I don't think so. Well, she was doing she was sort of doing acting and stuff, and
well, we know where she is now, obviously.
We know, obviously, now she's doing very well at comedy, but we the next morning we were like, you know, kind of, ooh, who's done this graffiti? Ooh, I don't know. Let's take a photo of it for our paper. But of course, we'd written this whole long slogan, sisterhood is powerful. It was so long, you couldn't get the whole thing in. So sort of we took this photo at an angle, and like the perspective makes it look a bit like sisterhood is poo.
Why are they saying sisterhood is poo?
So we lost something.
Well, you know, you learnt a valuable lesson about graffiti
and
photography. And what happened
absolutely.
To Kate?
Well, you have to see the show. Yeah, I did find her. She stays quite, well, I will say she stays quite a mysterious figure in the live show, but we are making, me and a bunch of other women who enjoyed the show, we're making a little guerrilla documentary version.
Fabulous.
That we're hoping to pitch and screen maybe at the BFI Flair Festival next year.
Great. And don't tell us.
So
will find out more. So if you've seen the live show, it's worth seeing the documentary.
Yeah, the documentary is going to have a slightly different ending.
Ooh. How exciting. And it turns out feminism was the winner in the end.
Hooray.
No, the whole thing. Hooray, hooray, hooray.
Well, what was nice was loads of young feminists came to see the show, actually, and they were, you know, they were really inspired and were, like, going away and kind of saying, we're going to set up our own zines. And you know, they were sort of 18, 19, and they were students now. And, you know, they were fascinated at all the kind of lo-fi technology I was talking about literally cutting and pasting our magazine together, you know, sticking it down with Pritt stick and Letraset.
It was
and
so
all
easy, though, wasn't it, really?
It was I don't think anyone was reading it, but...
like this show, it's just basically, may as well put it out there, but... Yeah, no, it's I wrote a play at Edinburgh last year called The Fair Intellectual Club, which was based on this true story of
And I think you were on at a similar time to me and I couldn't come.
Yes, indeed. Indeed, we clashed. But that was quite nice because it was based on this true story and I sort of had done research into this club of young women who had founded this intellectual society, you know, much against the customs of the day, and it sort of felt like a really nice little story to have uncovered. And what was lovely about that similarly was that there were women coming to see that, very young women, because these women were like 15 to 19, like, you know, in their teens. And and it is very inspiring, isn't it, when you go, that story from 300 years ago reached down through the ages to, you know, women who, and there's a group of girls from a school who are putting on their own version of the play now. It's really lovely. And, you know, hopefully more will be found out about this group. And it's
fantastic.
You know, hopefully we're inspiring, even now, we're inspiring young women.
We are. And I should say about 90s Women, I'm going to be doing it in London, upstairs at the Ritzy over in Brixton.
Oh, that's a nice space.
On July the 7th. So
very nice. Do you know what's lovely about that, listeners, is you can go and see it and enjoy the fabulous show and then also take the air on the Ritzy roof terrace.
Take the air.
After, it's one of my I used to live in Brixton.
Gone back to Victorian times.
take the air of Brixton.
Take a spin around Brixton.
The pleasure gardens.
Yes.
Well, Brixton is sort of now, it's so super genteel that I hardly recognise it. Interestingly, so how long have you lived in Brixton for?
Oh, well, I just moved there in the summer, actually, last year. But I was living not that far away. I was living in Peckham, East Dulwich.
Yes. Another area that has changed. Because I grew up around South London.
Amazingly,
unrecognisable.
Yeah. I mean, Peckham, in the years that I was there, because I was there a good few years, that it was amazing, the change. Yeah.
I know. And now none of us can afford to live there. So that's
indeed
all good. We've all had to move out of these places. I remember the Ritzy. I mean, I used to go to the Ritzy all the time. In the 90s, the whole of the 90s, basically, I was at the Ritzy.
You lived there.
One way or another. I did. But we had a friend who worked, we have a couple of friends who worked there. So we used to sort of try and sneak in.
Sneak in. Free tickets.
Well, actually, it never really worked out like that. But
you didn't need a ticket.
We kind of used to just go a lot and also go to that bar and the roof terrace. In fact, I remember we went to see, there was a film called
Mad Max.
Yes, if only. No. It was, what was it called? It was called something like Last Night, and it was a Canadian film about three people and a number of people, and it was their last night on Earth. They knew the world was going to end.
Oh, I didn't see it. I remember reading about
that. Yeah, it was quite a big sort of indie movie at the time, and I went to see that with my flatmates, and we were all living in this little flat in Brixton, and my flatmate Ian was working a bar and Sam was a nurse, and anyway, and we all went to see this film, and we stood on the terrace of the Ritzy upstairs afterwards.
Jumped off.
And we all said...
Yeah, I broke both my legs. I'm only just out. But no, we all said, oh, that film, it was life changing. And he gave up his job the next day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he said, right, that's it. If, you know, if the world was going to end, I wouldn't be wanting to do this. And I've often thought I would love to get in touch with him and find out how it all worked out for him. But I cannot for the life of me remember his surname.
Oh, no.
Ian, if you're out there.
Yeah,
Ian.
He was from Leeds. And right.
I'm writing this down.
He worked in a bar just
like guess
behind
who?
behind.
Did he have glasses?
Carnaby Street. Anyway, yeah, you never know. If anyone knows of Ian, yeah, my old flatmate, then please let me know what he's up to.
Oh, okay.
Should we? Yeah, in fact, it would be nice if we could resolve this during Pim's hour. If anyone could just get on the...
Many things have been resolved during Pim's hour.
We'll sort it out one way or another. Now, should we have another record, my darling?
Yes, let's...
record?
Should we have another disc?
How about a mini disc?
I've still got my mini disc player somewhere because I can't bear to throw it away because I spent so much money on it.
Yeah. And never used it.
And that's when I first started getting into radio and I was going to get all my interviews on it because for a while all the radio stations did use mini disc.
Yeah, and it was broadcast quality.
Do you remember
DATS?
I remember DATS. Mini tapes.
DATS.
Yeah, because I did one Edinburgh show. I recorded all of my audio. I'd done Vox Pops and recorded all of those on mini disc and painstakingly edited them. I've still got that somewhere. We'll have a mini disc festival.
Oh, let's bring in.
We've got the player so we can hook it up somehow.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we'll have that.
There you go, listeners. That's
if you love mini discs, you'll stay listening for the next couple of
weeks. I think it's time for another record from the album of the week.
Oh, lovely. From Kate Bush's The Whole Story. And then I tell you what, we can talk about the whole story after we come back.
What about Wow?
Yes.
Wow.
Let's have a bit of Wow.
Lucy Porter on FUBAR Radio.
And again, we crash a beautiful end of a song with the voice of Ali. That was Wow from Kate Bush's The Whole Story, which was a sort of, I was going to say mid-career, but sort of early career compilation, really. It was a kind of best of that EMI released I haven't actually looked, is that 1989, Amanda? Should we check? It was about then, anyway. Because I was going to choose The Kick Inside, but then we thought, actually, we may as well. We've got all the good stuff from that on this. Mm. Now, Kate Bush facts, some things that you may or may not know. We know that she's amazing. Mm. But did you know that Kate Bush was the first woman to have a self-penned number one record?
No.
Oh.
Pretty incredible. No woman had ever written her own number one until Kate Bush.
That's
Wuthering
incredible.
Heights.
Wow.
And I think, is Wuthering Heights still the only number one that she had? I think it probably is.
I think so, yeah.
There was another, I've forgotten what my other fact was, but it might come back to me. But anyway, but also I didn't get to see her in the recent live shows, which I will go to my grave regretting. Although she may well do some more, I think.
Do you reckon?
Well, it went well.
I heard.
If I were her, I'd do another tour. But she did. She had previously only done one tour.
Yeah.
And I respect her for that because, you know, I mean, I enjoy touring to a degree. but I don't know. I suspect if I could spend all my time in the studio being incredible. I mean, to me, Kate Bush and Björk are probably, you know, as a non-musician, they are the two that I think have the most creative control, the most sort of quirky take on life. That, you know, they just seem to have banged their own drum and ploughed their own furrow, if that's not mixing my metaphors.
I mean, someone like Tori Amos as well. I mean, I know she came a bit in the wake of Kate Bush and there were a lot of comparisons.
Yeah, I don't know that much about Tori Amos.
She's been very interesting as well. My partner is like super, super into her.
Yeah.
And she has done some really great stuff.
Did you go and see the musical, the recent... was it a musical or a sort of theatrical event, wasn't there?
I didn't actually, no.
There was some recent thing, I think, that she was...
And another really interesting woman, I think, is PJ Harvey.
Yes, I love PJ Harvey. Yes, and sort of lyrically very interesting and... you know, it has done a variety of different mad things, which I quite enjoy.
Yeah, definitely.
Beth Orton, does Beth Orton still do much?
Not so much now. I did interview her once back in the old 90s, I used to do a bit of music journalism as well, mostly for magazines that no longer exist. I killed them all off, but I used to do Time Out as well a bit, back when Time Out had lots of actual content.
yes, before it was free.
Yes, exactly, before it became free. But yeah, I did interview Beth Thornton. I had a breakfast interview with her for a magazine called Making Music that no longer exists. But I used to love her stuff, that sort of early stuff of hers. But actually, I should have a gripe with her, because I remember I once sent my demo tape to Heavenly Records, and back in the mid-90s, and they said, oh, we can't sign you, we do quite like your stuff, but we just signed a woman, and it was her.
Oh, yeah. It's a, yeah, we've all had that conversation.
Can't have more than one woman, yeah, that's, on a comedy bill or on a record label.
Our chick quota is full now, yeah, thank you very much. Who were your influences growing up then?
What, music people?
Well, let's do music and then let's do comedy, because you'd straddle both worlds.
Straddle.
Again, we've got back to sex again, haven't we?
I know. Oh, dear. Yes, we have. It's like a carry-on film.
Oh, misses. Now, who did you like when you were...
Well, it's funny, we laughed about George Michael, actually, but probably my sort of early crushes were on both George and Andrew Ridgeley.
Yes.
I used to be so into Wham when I was a young teen, and my first ever gig I did in the front garden with the two next door neighbours, the Witherspees, Katie and Ewan, and it was really just me corralling them into doing. I'd sort of written all the songs and I was playing the synthesizer and singing, and they were just sort of doing backing vocals. This set up the whole power dynamic for many of my projects in later life, really. and I can remember the artwork I drew for the poster was very much modelled on the artwork for Wham's kind of early albums.
I can picture
and stuff.
It now. Yeah, sort of slightly that 80s kind of jaggedy writing.
Kind of look,
They were actually a very... I mean, George Michael's
George
such an amazing
songwriter and a great vocalist, actually. But I know, you know, perhaps he's lost his way.
Well, I recognised even at the time, even though I was not... I mean, I was, as we've established, I was a music snob. And even at that age, under the influence of my older sister, I was an indie kid. And I was like, oh, pop music is beneath me. It's terrible.
It's terrible, yeah.
Actually, I did always think, oh, but Wham.
Yeah.
I mean,
but then I started getting into other stuff. I remember I loved Tears for Fears and Depeche Mode and those kind of bands as well.
Shout, let it all out.
Yeah, but I loved Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I used to sort of play all those songs,
I don't know,
from that album.
When I was on holiday, I did aqua aerobics in the pool because I'm an old lady.
Marvellous.
And they did Everybody Wants to Rule the World, and I found myself singing along as I was there with my pool noodle, pushing it up and down. They're amazing. It's, you know, great songs from the 80s.
Great songs. And then, you know, obviously when I came to London and it was the 90s, and stuff, then listening to slightly more serious stuff. I remember Jeff Buckley's album Grace was a big one.
God, again, let's,
someone
like
else
Kirsten
that we
McCall,
have to toast.
Oh no. Let's clink our tins. Clink your tins, everybody. Do that at home. If you've got a tin of special brew on the go, then do that.
Lots of people to clink. Yes.
Jeff Buckley. Now, I remember watching a documentary about him and Liz Fraser.
Oh, Cocteau Twins.
The Cocteau Twins. Now, were they an item or were they just artistically
involved?
I don't know. I got the impression that maybe there was a thing there. Anyway, that's just gossip. I'm just idle
theorist. Just idle gossip.
But yes, Jeff Buckley, that Lover You Should Have Come Over.
Oh.
Oh, God. I tell you what, that is the kind of song that I would put on a compilation and be quite happily having intercourse, and then that would come on and kill the mood, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you'd cry.
Yeah, you would. So good depressing musical influences.
What about
your comedy influences? Zoe Lyons, obviously, in the day.
Definitely. You know, it was very inspiring when Zoe sort of told me she was doing comedy, because, you know, by that stage we were both sort of into our 30s, and you kind of think maybe you're not allowed to kind of start something new something like comedy, which seems like, you know, a blokey
young man's game.
But, you know, but Zoe was doing it, and so that was kind of inspiring. It felt like someone like me was doing it, and I sort of started dipping my toes into those comedy waters, because I'd always chatted in between my songs and kind of.
Some of the funniest people I've ever seen have been musicians. I mean, like Billy Bragg. You would always go and see Billy Bragg and you would laugh and laugh, and he would be an amazing inter-song chatter.
Yeah. But
This is a possible opportunity to plug a book that we've both contributed to. Because
What the Frog.
What the Frog, which is a comedy club in Bristol, have released a book celebrating female comedians, which I have written the foreword for, and you have contributed... an article about
Zoe Lyons.
There you go.
Yeah, and there's lots of people writing about female acts that have inspired them. Yeah,
it's a very... I have read much of it and intend to read it all in the fullness of time, and it is very inspiring. Because, I didn't actually get around to writing a piece for it about comedians, but there were so many that I thought, I could do. Well, Carolina Hearn was one who sprang me to one. Joe Brand, I'm sure someone would have done Joe Brand, but I mean, she was a massive influence.
But I think for me, initially, I used to watch Victoria Wood with my mum. I mean, I know that's a classic one that so many people say, but you know, just her and Julie Walters, just the kind of chemistry between them. And some of those classic sketches, like, you know, Two Soups and the shoe shop one. Yeah, and all of those. Yeah. It's just brilliant.
Yeah.
Just really, really inspiring. But Eddie Izzard as well was a really big one for me.
I went through a period of basically trying to sound like Eddie Izzard. Because when I started doing comedy, it was in Manchester, and Chris Addison was starting around the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And he and I were basically competing to see who could do the most Eddie Izzard style mannerisms and vocal tics. And, we both worked our way through it in the end, I think. It's like, there was a period a few years ago where every comedian who was starting out sounded like Daniel Kitson to like a worrying degree. But you just thought, no, you've got to find your own voice. And most of them eventually you did, and some of them went on to be incredibly successful now. Yeah. But a lot of them started off being basically Daniel Kitson tribute acts. And if you're going to be a tribute act, why not?
I was just going to say, I guess that happens a lot musically, doesn't it? If it's a band's popular, then you're going to get everybody replicating that, aren't they? People in their garages wanting to be the next Mumford and Sons.
Back at Mumford and Sons. But look at the 90s and how you had all these kind of terrible guitar bands in the wake of Oasis and all of that.
Well, I remember, I mean, my heyday really was the... There was Stourbridge, and there was a sort of a whole West Midlands scene, which was people like Pot Will Eat Itself and the Wonder Stuff.
Oh yeah! Oh gosh! Yeah, yeah. And that whole.
But you know, when you go, well, Pot Will Eat Itself and the Wonder Stuff, you kind of, they were the ones who were the kind of trailblazers, and you remember. But there were hundreds, and I used to go and see them at the World's End pub in Camden. I used to trek up there, and they all used to play. And like now, I can't remember half the names of them. But there were like anyone who lived in Stourbridge. I did a gig in Stourbridge at the football club recently. And I did say this was like, this is my musical mecca from the 90s. and it turns out like anyone who had a guitar or access to one in the 90s was in a band, which is quite amazing for a tiny place like that. Yes. Anyway, so that's good. Yeah. So comedy influences. And we should plug the What the Frock book, which you can buy from their website, I think. Probably from other places as well, but What the Frock.
I think it's best to buy it from the website.
Presumably they get more of the money.
Because they get more of the money,
Yeah, I know. Have you got any merchandise, Rosie?
No.
I should have. We should all have merchandise.
I know. Well, like, what merchandise do you have?
Nothing. And what we should do...
We are rather shoddy, aren't we?
We should have old back copies of The Matrix... You should have those available.
For sale,
Just, you know, because now you
I've
can photocopy
I've only got one
copy.
Well, I could photocopy them,
You could do good photocopies of that. Well, because
because it was only photocopy quality in the first place.
Well, exactly.
You
probably
didn't have
better,
very good printing,
if anything, now. Because when I did the play The Fair Intellectual Club, to which I referred, there was a pamphlet written by this original club on which the play was based. And I had faithfully typed it out because it's, you know, the old manuscript. It's all in that 18th century, you know, the S's look like F's and all that. So I typed it all out and did it. And then I was, like, when people came to see the play, I put on the programme, listen, if you want a copy of the original manuscript, just email me and I'll send it to you. And then someone said, you should be charged, like, charge them 20p or something, just a token. And I just thought, but it didn't cost me anything. I think the problem is I have to develop a business mindset. What was the product we were going to make?
Oh, that was, I've got it.
Oh, the high heel breathalyzer.
High heel breathalyzer. Oh, okay, right. Well, I'll get a prototype of that sorted out.
And for next week?
I think I could probably do it for next week.
Wow, that's great.
I mean, it might not be a very comfortable high heel or a very accurate breathalyzer, but it will
be. No, high heel is a comfortable high heel.
No, exactly, it probably won't. Sticking a couple of breathalyzers on your high heels, probably no worse. Do you know, I think I've just found a segue there. It just suddenly occurred to me that there was a story that might just tie into our breathalyzer, which was more women Or women are not getting the drink drive message, say the Police Federation. So more should be done to discourage women from driving while drunk, the Police Federation says. It says female drink driving levels are not falling quickly enough as warnings are not getting through. So it's just an interesting social trend, I thought, that drink driving in men has been decreasing, even though more men than women are still caught
drink
driving.
Yeah, well, I think it's quite interesting the way they interpret these statistics, you know, like that's the thing that they've pulled out, because it's still way less women
than
men,
isn't it?
You know, I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, like there should be equality in drink driving.
Just
to
give you the stats, so the women found guilty of driving under the influence of drugs in England and Wales rose from 9,007 in 2011 to 9,586 in 2012, right? Would you care to guess?
2012, was it anything to do with the Olympics?
We were all busy training. We'd all seen the Olympics and we were like, I'm going to get fit. I'm going to give up the booze. But would you care to hazard a guess at the number of men? So the number of women convicted in 2012 of drink driving or drug driving was 9,586. Men, how many men were convicted in 2012 of drink or drug driving? So you're going from a figure of 9,500 to...
I don't know, about 30,000 or 40,000?
It's 45,500. Wow. So, I mean, yes, statistically, you're a lot more likely to get into a car with a sober woman than a sober man. But I mean, I suppose the fact that the figures are falling for men.
And especially if you had a high heel breathalyzer.
Yes, this could be the thing that revolutionises it all,
this could
is
be
that women.
The thing.
Well,
absolutely.
Also, because.
I mean, I'm a terrible driver. I quite like my passengers to be drunk.
Yes. Good. I'm glad you said, you know, this is a. I'm delighted you say that because I'm a terrible driver as well. And it's very rare to meet other people who admit to it. But
I
good
know,
for
yeah,
you.
No, no. I don't really drive now, to be honest. I've always gone out with people who will drive me around.
Yeah.
This is probably why my relationships always break up when I'm serial monogamous, because I expect them to be a taxi service.
Yeah,
really.
Well, the minute their car breaks down, you're off to somebody
else. Right, I'm off.
The car has
I'm
a shelf life of a certain amount of years. Yeah, I am very much one of nature's passengers.
Yeah, indeed.
I know, but
it's awful. That's sort of playing into the whole gender stereotype thing, isn't it? We were talking about right at the beginning that women are bad drivers, but I feel I shouldn't. I shouldn't maybe confess to my terrible driving.
In fact, on this very show, because I was bidding to be the presenter of Top Gear, the new presenter of Top Gear, which I don't, and they haven't announced it yet, have they?
No.
I wonder if it's because my agent is not passing on the message.
It could be. It's because you've been on holiday, Lucy. And you didn't have any internet.
I'm back now, guys. Guys, you can get in touch. But yeah, I did say exactly this, Rosie. I was like, I would like to be the presenter of Top Gear, just because I'm not very good at driving. I think it'd be hilarious, but. I do. The thing is, I know a lot more women who are amazing drivers, and statistically, women are much less likely to be involved in accidents. We're, much safer drivers. But then I think a lot, some men that I know go, safer drivers, not very good drivers. Huh. And I don't see what that distinction is, really.
Yeah.
What do they mean? Not very fast.
Yeah, interesting. Which is actually, I am quite an interesting driver. So
I am
certainly fascinating behind
you
the
make
wheel.
Interesting patterns.
I do.
In
the
snow.
When we were on holiday, there was talk of hiring a car, and I was like, no, do you know, if I can't drive in my home country,
I'm not going to try it.
Go on the wrong side.
Drove in America, and it was terrifying for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, God, they've got guns here. It's all very well me driving badly at home, but this could potentially be disastrous. Sort of women and drinking, and we are sort of, it was something that in
we're
the 90s.
We're on dodgy ground here.
With our pims out, aren't we?
But,
because in the 90s it became this thing of, women are basically the way that we showed our empowerment was by getting as drunk as men and being ladettes. But women do seem to be consistently drinking more.
Mm.
And I think it's because life is awful.
Well, I feel better
after that.
The
depressing song.
The whole show, we're going to have to end up with something really, really bleak. But it's true. I think the interesting thing is, as you say, it's the way that we look at statistics is always how can we paint this as women are doing a bad thing or being shameful and disgraceful.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing I was going to bring up, we were talking at the very beginning of the show, for those of you who've stuck with us for the entire 2 hours.
Well done.
Well done.
Don't forget, guys.
Do you remember many, many hours ago I was saying that I had stormed out of the country after the election result?
Oh, yes.
But the and it's good we have the gayest parliament in the world, but also just interesting to look at the stats about the women in parliament. So the number of women in parliament has risen by about a third to 191. Mm. Female MPs now make up 29% of the overall title, overall total. Even I mean, and they're all drunk.
Yes,
the proportion of female Conservative and Labour MPs has increased despite an overall fall in the number of Labour MPs. But the biggest rise in female representation in the Commons came from the
SNP.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Which now has 20 female MPs, up from just one.
Wow.
To be fair,
they've got quite a lot more male MPs as well. They've just got a lot more MPs.
They did very well, didn't they? And have looked delighted. I mean, it has been the loveliest thing.
Yeah.
About how delighted they are to be in Parliament. I mean, yeah. It's a really, it just goes to show, you know, that an injection of new blood.
Yeah.
Everyone was, much more sort of chipper about. About coming into Parliament. And the youngest female MP.
Oh, yes.
Who is, I believe, 20 years old.
Mm. Wow.
But who has, I think, suffered from what I predicted would happen to members of this generation. Her tweets and her Facebook posts have been used against her.
Yeah.
And I think it just goes to show. I think this is, like, with Chuka Umunna withdrawing from the Labour leadership race because of the pressure.
He's my MP.
Everyone says he's a very good constituency MP. Well, in fact, Sadiq Khan is my friend's MP down in Tooting and Streatham, Tooting. And she was saying he's amazing and he's standing for Labour mayor because I was backing him. I thought, he's going to run for leader. But I think he'll be mayor in a Boris Johnson way. Sadiq Khan will be mayor, then he'll be Labour leader. Mm-hmm. In no time at all. But anyway, is the pressure on MPs and on their personal lives now, I think it's only going to get worse. And I can't see anyone wanting to be an MP in a few years' time.
What's going to happen?
I don't know. I mean, there must be a way where you can just delete all of your social media.
Life.
Yes. Just start afresh. Because I did feel really sorry for that girl. Because it was just that she liked to drink. And I think she'd been slightly anti-English in the context of the referendum debate.
Yeah.
But I mean,
we were
all drunk. We'd all had a drink, let's face it, at that point. it will be interesting to see how she gets on there. And I wish her all the best and applaud her. And also, Tommy Shepherd, who is the man who runs the Stand Comedy Club, is now an MP, which is brilliant. And I am delighted about that because he's a good egg. He's an all-round good egg.
A good egg. Did you see there was a House of Commons documentary that sort of followed a lot of MPs, and particularly quite a few women? It was really interesting, sort of watching them kind of juggling having young kids and sort of picking young children up and running to the vote when the division bell sounded.
Yes.
And I thought, well, it must be really tough if you've got kids and you're sort of juggling that.
As much as they've tried to sort of revise the hours and make it a bit more family-friendly,
it's
never going to be a family-friendly
job,
is it?
No, not really.
But yeah, because there was someone who was sort of breastfeeding and trying to get into debates as well. Mary Black is the 20-year-old youngest elected MP. Youngest elected MP since 1667.
Wow.
Even I don't go that far back. Even I don't know. Right, now, I think we're going to have... Time is rushing on.
It is.
And we
is,
need to finish quite soon. But I want to do a song from you, Amanda.
Okay.
Because it's been your birthday. And I didn't get you a present, so my present to you is
I seriously thought it was in your bag.
I know. Sorry.
So my present is a song that I chose myself on the...
Your present will be a shoe breathalyzer.
That's the prototype.
Which is really handy because I don't drive. So, right.
Yeah, but you might need to know if you're drunk for other reasons.
Like if you've got to walk down a red carpet.
Indeed. Yeah. There you go. I'm helping you out in so many ways. So
I think I'd rather be drunk if I was walking down a red carpet.
Well,
I've done it once.
Just pop your flats on, but not if you're at Cannes. Mm-hmm. You see.
No, yeah. Okay, so we'll quickly do a track and then we can say...
We'll say bye then.
Say goodbye.
Say bye.
So this track is Heads Will Roll by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
Oh, you like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, don't you?
I do.
Oh.
Dance, dance, dance till you're dead.
Oh, There we have it. It's Amanda's birthday treat. Amanda's special birthday present. Yes, exactly. Well, we've had a lovely time.
Yeah.
That's the important thing. She's had a lovely birthday.
Smash it.
And I've had a lovely time. Thank you, Rosie, for coming in and joining us.
Thank you. It's been
nothing
fun.
But pleasure.
Nothing but pleasure.
Anything you want us to come and see that you're doing?
Well, like I said, 90s Woman is on at upstairs at the Ritzy in Brixton, July the 7th. It's on around about some other places as well. But
Let's all go to Brixton. And you've got your website.
I've got my website, rosiewilby.com.
Yeah, exactly. We'll find you.
Yeah.
Somehow we'll find you. Well, also, if anyone wants to get in touch about anything that's been on the show, then you can tweet me. I've got a ridiculous Twitter name, at Luna Bimberton. LONABIMBERTON. It's ridiculous. But if you search Lucy Porter, you'll find me or a very nice Irish PR lady who often refers people back to me because they've tweeted her in error. Anyway, and there's probably some FUBAR. What's the FUBAR address?
At FUBAR Radio.
There you go. Ooh, good. Tweet, email. You can find my website as well. And we will see you next week. We're going to be back. No holidays for us anymore. We're going to be back with some depressing songs and some chat and some pims. So please do join us next week. And we're going to have a final track from the wonderful Kate Bush.
Yeah. It's in the trees. It's coming.